Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Career diplomats insist politics is not part of their jobs, but the impeachment hearings are threatening that norm.
This is what I can't believe, and you're their star witness. I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 14th, we'll look at the impact of partisan attacks on State Department officials. Also on the podcast, how the ouster of Bolivian President Evo Morales underscores widespread unrest across Latin America.
If this isn't a coup, then the word coup has no meaning. He was forced to resign by the head of the military. That's pretty much textbook coup.
And an Oscars disqualification for Nigeria's best international film entry has led many to question what the category really stands for.
There are certain international films that need to be in English for their primary audience to understand what's going on in the film. And of course, these countries include former colonies of Britain.
We'll start with the impeachment drama. Let's get going. For career diplomats, politics is not supposed to be part of the job.
Ms. Ratcliffe, if I can just respond, let me just reiterate.
I've got 1 minute left.
I know you only got a minute left.
I'll withdraw the question.
I'm not here to take one side or the other. That's your
Ambassador, decision. Let me answer this.
The general will suspend.
As Republicans sought to discredit the narrative laid out by State Department officials William Taylor and George Kent during Wednesday's live impeachment hearings, the tone was sharp and often combative.
Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? You didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Lindsey's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about, as far as I know.
This is what I can't believe, and you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
Mr. Jordan, you're the guy.
I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this.
And while the two officials emphasized their histories of working for administrations on both sides of the aisle, the hearings became yet another example of how partisanship is undermining the credibility of U.S. foreign policy. Joining me now for more on this is Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter at Politico. Nahal, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of fireworks, unfortunately, yesterday. Let's talk a little bit about the top of the hearings. Devin Nunes said that Kent and Taylor are part of a, quote, politicized bureaucracy participating in a, quote, cult-like atmosphere. Can you explain that tone from the beginning?
Well, basically, the Republicans want to paint these people as not being credible. And so they're making the argument that people who work in the government as career civil servants or foreign service officers are part of like this kind of conspiratorial deep state and that they're out to get President Trump. Whereas, you know, the real situation is that these are people who are sworn to serve any administration and implement the policies of that administration, regardless of political party. And so for Devin Nunes to go out there and make this comment, it's basically an attempt to tell everyone, hey, don't believe these guys. These are, you know, just bureaucrats and they're politicized. And actually, it's a very kind of dangerous shift in the thinking, because in past administrations, you've never really had this, where Republicans are trying to attack the bureaucracy in this particular manner.
Also, one of the things that we saw, I mean, we talk about, as you mentioned, the president talks a lot about the deep state, but according to Ambassador Taylor in yesterday's testimony, in Ukraine, there were two groups running diplomatic policy, and one of them were sort of on the official United States docket, and the other was not official. And so there were two channels of diplomacy happening here, one that was sort of a shadow channel. What risk does that represent for U.S. foreign policy overall? Because we heard, the Ukrainian government was quite confused about what messages they were getting.
Well, confusion is the problem, right? I mean, and this has been an issue from the beginning of the Trump administration, is that the president says one thing, his aides say different things. And so people within the government are not exactly sure what the policy is. And then when they're communicating to people overseas, these people overseas are hearing from multiple different channels, and not to mention reading the president's tweets. And so they are not sure what U.S. policy is. And it's not just Ukraine. I mean, you can look at what recently happened with Trump's desire to remove troops from Syria to understand the kind of confusion that comes about. And this is very interesting because, you know, part of the reason you have like bureaucrats or career civil servants, those sort of things, is that you have a sense of continuity and expertise and a certain level of consistency, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Because in the past, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations, they basically at the end of the day had a general similar vision of foreign policy, you know, America leading, America being strong, that sort of thing. They obviously went about in different ways. But now it's like when you have one administration and multiple different messages coming from that administration. If you're a diplomat overseas, if you're a president somewhere else in another country, you're not sure what to believe.
No, one of the things that also was pretty striking was when both of the diplomats, Kent and Taylor, were asked directly whether or not they were never Trumpers. And I thought that that exchange was almost reminiscent of previous hearings that we've seen in history, most notably questioning the political affiliations of State Department officials. What was your take on that?
Well, it was a very striking exchange as well. And, you know, they both, George Kent, basically, his response was, look, I've worked for 27 years under both Democrats and Republicans. I am a career professional. And Bill Taylor basically just said, no, sir, as in, I am not an ever Trumper. It's important to understand that, you know, for career foreign service officers and civil servants, they might have personal opinions. I mean, everybody does have personal thoughts, right? But they take an oath not to let that influence their work. And, you know, these two guys insist that what they are trying to do is just what's in the interest of national security and implementing the president's policies. But of course, it gets a little bit confusing when, you know, the vice president says one thing, the president says another thing, Rudy Giuliani says a third thing. Your own diplomats are not entirely sure what they are supposed to be doing.
And Nihal, of course, one thing that didn't get as much coverage was the fact that President Trump welcomed Turkish President Erdogan to the White House. Turkey is, of course, at the center of Trump's controversial foreign policy involving the Kurds. What was the significance of the timing of that meeting? Did it just happen to coincide with the impeachment hearings, or was there more to it?
I think, you know, it was not intentional in terms of the timing when it comes to the impeachment hearings. What really has upset a lot of people on the Hill, though, and I should say both Republicans and Democrats, is that they feel like after what Turkey did in Syria, which is invading Syria and pushing out Kurdish forces who had been working with Americans, that Erdogan did not deserve to have a visit to the White House. And so there's been a lot of anger and frustration over that. And they don't understand why Trump allowed him to come. Interestingly, the weird thing is that, you know, Turkey is actually historically one of those states where there has been a deep state because there was the military and others who had kind of this role in actually running things despite what the people may have wanted. And so it's just that is historically kind of one of those funny, interesting little footnotes that came about yesterday.
Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter at Politico. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Sunday, Bolivian President Evo Morales stepped down from office after 14 years in power to ease the increasingly violent protests that have rattled the country in recent weeks.
He decidido renunciar a mi cargo de presidencia.
The country's military pressured Morales to resign after a report from the Washington, D.C.-based Organization of American States cited voting irregularities during Bolivia's October 20th election. Morales has since fled to Mexico, seeking political asylum. But his departure comes at a time of increasing political unrest across Latin America in countries like Chile, Ecuador, and Venezuela. Joining me now are Jorge Alves, an associate professor of political science at Queens College, CUNY, and Greg Grandin, a history professor at Yale University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yes, happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
So, Jorge, on Tuesday, Bolivian Senator Jeanine Añez appointed herself acting president of Bolivia. Was this expected, and what do we know about her?
Well, to the extent that we can say anything was expected in this kind of situation is she was the last person standing who was in line, right? When Morales was asked to resign and then resigned, many other people from his party and his government resigned as well. She represents a completely different group than the group that had been governing. You know, she's more conservative. She was a business person, a couple of different things. She said a couple of things that clearly state that she's bringing in some different views. So, for example, her cabinet doesn't have any indigenous people on it. It's more connected to religious right, more conservative in terms of pro-market views as well. So there's clearly a change here. Now, whether her taking the power of the presidency, considering there was no quorum, we're at the technicality range here when there's a rupture, where we don't know exactly if you're following the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, but clearly she has the support of the army. It seems to be that in that vacuum, to the extent that anybody's leading right now, that's her.
And I want to ask a little bit more about her comments that she's made regarding indigenous peoples. Has she made racist comments about this community? And if so, is this an affront to Morales's heritage and what he represented for Bolivia?
I would say that she is an out-and-out white supremacist. She represents a sector of the opposition that is extremely, extremely racist. You can look through her Twitter feed before this happened, and she has some remarkable quotes about Indians should stay in the countryside. One of her first acts was to return the Bible into the National Palace because it's been polluted and corrupted by indigenous cosmology or indigenous spiritual beliefs over the last 10 years. And I just want to point out, it's not just really a technicality. It's out and out coercion. The next in line to the presidency after the forced resignation, the coup against Evo Morales and his vice president, was another member of Morales's party. And these people resigned because they were terrorized. I mean, the houses have been looted. And since then, let me say, courageously, the next in line, the member of Morales's party, has tried to enter the National Palace. And she has been denied, prevented by the police and the military. This is just an ongoing coup.
Greg, you're definitively calling it a coup. How do you define that? Because there's been a lot of back and forth over whether this was a coup or an uprising. Why are you choosing to define it in that way?
If this isn't a coup, then the word coup has no meaning. He was forced to resign by the head of the military. That's pretty much textbook definition of a coup, even if people might dispute some of the other facts or what the process and larger context is.
But I think it's also important to say that democratic breakdowns are a longer process. Even during the Morales government, what you're seeing is that he's going up for his fourth term. The Constitution says that you're only allowed two. So what we're seeing is a longer process of erosion, either chipping away slowly or a more abrupt type of intervention.
Georgie, I do want to get into the complicated relationship that the United States has had with Bolivia since Morales took office in 2005 and what we know about the role the United States has played in all of this so far.
I think not just with Bolivia, but with Latin America in general. This goes back to imperial times, or it goes back to, you know, the Cold War. And these are the memories that are in everybody's heads. From what I can see, I don't think in this situation, the United States actually needed to get involved directly. There's a bunch of macro processes that have been working towards this kind of crisis. The end of the commodity boom, the fact that all these countries now, because of neoliberal reforms in the 1990s, are more exposed to international markets, which groups are getting represented, which kinds of policies. You have the pink tide or the left turn that kind of crested in the 2000s and after the commodity boom now has seemed to turn. And Morales was one of the last survivors of this. There's no other left leaders really to stand up and support through the OAS or through other institutions. And there's also this rise of this conservative backlash, right, now tied to conservative evangelicals and things like that that are rising across Latin America. And if you think about it, that's also a transnational stretch. I mean, who brought Protestantism to Latin America? It was missionaries that come from here, right? Changing the nature of Latin American politics as well, not just in Bolivia, but in Brazil and a bunch of other places.
Following on that, I wanted to bring Greg in here because I want to hear, Greg, your thoughts on what the United States' presence in Bolivia has meant for Bolivians and the country.
Well, the United States between 1899 and 1994 overthrew successfully 41 governments, presided over 41 regime changes in Latin America. I do want to say that all of those coups you could say, had popular support. The president might have been problematic. There was a larger context, but U.S. support and intervention was crucial. I agree that there's a larger context in which Morales was operating, but it's not so much what the U.S. did. The U.S. always has to act in tandem with local actors. In this case, the local actors are scary. It's not just Inez, it's also Luis Camacho, who represents the lowlands, a really fascistic organization of white supremacy, that he has been central in this coup. He's been called the Bolsonaro of Bolivia. It represents a new kind of very aggressive, Trump-like political formation. Morales has presided over 15 years of unbelievable, one, economic growth, two, economic equalization, and three, political stability for a large degree. And this is unique for Bolivia. Bolivia is no stranger to popular uprisings. It's the remarkable political transformation and opening up and democratization of society that Morales has presided over.
I want to bring in Georgi again to that point, because we see Morales's departure, and we're also seeing the rise of a couple of things happening across Latin America. We've seen leftist leaders regain power in countries like Mexico and Argentina. We've seen Bolsonaro, far right, gaining power in Brazil. And we're also seeing tensions playing out, particularly in countries like Brazil, of indigenous populations fighting back. There have been some folks who say that what happened with Morales here was less about election irregularities and voting irregularities and more about the ouster of indigenous power and indigenous movement. Georgi, how do you respond to that? What does Morales' departure mean for the rest of Latin America right now, given all of those trends that we're seeing?
First, I'd like to say that I agree with Greg with the point is that, you know, one of the benefits of the Morales, you know, period is that it was in a stability that Bolivia is not used to. It is one of the highest in terms of countries in terms of experiencing interrupted presidencies, right? So Morales is the 27th, counting impeachments, coups, whatever. So it's a period of relative stability. But I think the important thing is to not mix the socioeconomic policies that it stands for, the inclusion of previously excluded groups, the racial groups that had been excluded forever. There had never been an indigenous president of Bolivia before, you know, declining poverty, declining inequality, things like that, with the institutional part, which is the autocratic temptations of that Latin American leaders tend to have, this feeling that I alone can save and represent the people and save the country. So I think the problem that the danger in Bolivia with some of these less than democratic, certainly not liberal rights, is that the indigenous portion of this, the equality part of the leftist platform, will get rolled into all the other stuff that people are angry about. Just like in the Bolsonaro situation, right? So because of an economic crisis and corruption, you ended up having a real step back in terms of policies of inclusion of racial minorities, of LGBTQ types of policies. We're going to be a God-loving nation again. So the danger is that in this backlash that brings together people who are conservative in different ways, right? Economically conservative, some people socially conservative, some people religiously conservative. In this backlash, you get all of these unquestionably positive policies introduced by leftist governments, and they're going to all get thrown out with the bathwater. And I think this is a danger for Latin America now. I think what we're seeing is that leaders during tough times, they get punished much more often. And this is why, for example, the president of Argentina right now lost now to the left. So it's not necessarily a left-right necessarily thing. I mean, I think it's a horrible thing to be a president during hard economic times internationally. This reflects internally in terms of economic growth and so in terms of social protest. And then this creates this rupture between the opposition and the incumbents. And democracy is what? Democracy is a system to generate legitimacy to rule. For that, people need to see each other as opponents, not enemies. And this is clearly not the case in this Bolivian election, right? So nobody trusts anybody to run this election. So when Evo Morales extends the, you know, his hand out and says, okay, fine, OAS calls for new elections, let's have new elections, there was this backlash of people who clearly, for one reason or another, don't believe that they can trust the process. And this is bad. This is bad for democracy, not only in Bolivia, but in Latin America in general.
Jorge Alves is an associate professor of political science at Queens College, and Greg Grandin is a professor of history at Yale University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. The Academy Awards has come under fire after disqualifying the Nigerian film Lionheart from the Best International Film category. According to the Academy's rules, the movie contained too much English to make the Oscars cut.
That will be over my dead body.
Get it over your dead body. Company.
Nigeria is home to Nollywood, the world's second largest film industry. And while it produces local language films, the majority of Nollywood's movies are in English, which is the official language of the country. The choice to exclude Lionheart from Oscar competition has ignited a conversation about the history of colonialism, language, and race, at least here in the United States. For more on this, I'm joined by Antoinette Isama, a freelance writer. Hi, Antoinette.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And from Lagos, Nigeria, we have Ifeoma Fafunwa, a playwright, director, and founder of Eye Open Eye Productions. Hi, Ifeoma.
Thank you for having me.
Antoinette, was it really a question of language in terms of why Lionheart was disqualified?
According to them, yes.
And what are the rules? Like, what were the rules that they were citing here?
They were saying that any film that wants to be considered for this category needs to not be in English, predominantly in English. However, there are certain international films that, you know, need to be in English for their primary audience to understand what's going on in the film. And of course, these countries include former colonies of Britain. And in turn of being a former colony of Britain, the official languages of these respective countries is English. So there's a big question mark there.
A big question mark that's gotten a lot of attention. Ifeoma, you are in Nigeria right now. What is the feeling among the Nigerian filmmakers that you know and talk to?
To be honest, it's not as topical as it is in the U.S. and internationally here. I'm surprised that the first news I heard of it came from outside Nigeria, and of course it's all over the internet. But here they aren't as tuned in, because I think historically it is a lot of pushback around America now on establishment and, you know, historical corporations, organizations that may have excluded minorities.
Is it also a question, Ifeoma, of the fact that, as we mentioned at the top, Nigeria is the second largest film industry in the world? And really, I mean, does it matter if they're in the Oscars or not? Or maybe that's part of the reason why we here in the United States are making a bigger deal of it than Nigerians in Nigeria?
Exactly. I think so one of the opportunities this brings up is for Nigerians themselves to ask, you know, how does this matter, and should they really be investing? The Nollywood industry really was built historically on just the sweat and grit of ordinary citizens that just took little video cameras and made films, giving themselves jobs, facing unemployment, etc. This movement sort of overlooks that history. 200 million Nigerians and Nigerians in the diaspora have been watching Nigerian films, plus Nigerians in the diaspora and Africans in the diaspora have been watching Nollywood films for 20 years. And I feel like this sort of, you know, places a shadow on that reality. But I like this controversy because I think it shines a light on what is possible for Nigeria.
Antoinette, I would love your thoughts on that, because it is a different situation here in the United States. The Oscars in particular have been criticized, you know, think back to April Ryan's hashtag Oscars So White. And there are people who say that there's an undercurrent of bias in this decision from the Oscars. What do you say to that, Antoinette? And then what do you think of Ifeoma's reaction from Nigeria?
Yeah, I think thanks to social media platforms, there's more of a democratization of people sharing their thoughts and calling to question establishment and quote unquote rules and who those rules apply to. As early as yesterday, there's another film that was considered for the running. It was called Joy for Austria. That was also disqualified for the same reason. And the storyline was, again, based centers on Nigerian sex workers in Vienna. So I think it just calls to question, like, is there a standard as to what English is? Because there are different variants of English. Even in Nigeria and other African countries, like, people would consider how they approach English to be a dynamic take on what English is. So is it really about a standard? Is it not? If you look at the stories that are being told through these films that are being disqualified, what do they look like? They're Black.
And let's talk about that, because Ifeoma made an interesting point that in Nigeria, at least right now, among the creatives and filmmakers that she's speaking to, there's sort of a shrug at the controversy.
Yeah, and I totally understand, because in terms of how I even wanted to contribute to the conversation, I at least wanted to bring up that there are academies and entities on the continent that have been doing the work. Now we have to ask ourselves, are we even paying attention to what they're doing? And in what ways can we continue to amplify those platforms?
Ifeoma, one of the things that came up also is that a lot of Lionheart is in colloquial Nigerian English, which is a variant of English that's mostly foreign to a lot of Americans here in the United States. These dialects are often spoken by low-income people of color in other countries. Do you think classism played into this at all?
No, I don't. I think Lionheart is a great movie. I've seen it. I've seen Joy. I think they're both wonderful movies. But I think the broader issue of, you know, when you go on the Academy's list of requirements, it clearly states that 50% of the film needs to be in a language other than English. And it's been that way I remember 30 years ago logging on to find out the requirements. It's not something that is new. Yes, the Academy now maybe can review and see if some of their laws and rules are outdated. But countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada that speak English, once you start opening up English language and dialects, then Brooklyn and Savannah, Georgia qualify for English language dialects in terms of pronunciation. I mean, it becomes very open on the list of languages. Pidgin English is considered a different language. Here we have more than 60% of the film, 70% of the film in English.
Ifeoma, when you think about whether or not, you mentioned earlier that the rules are the rules, right? The Oscars for international film submissions have their rules. 50% of it has to be in a language other than English. Do you think those rules should be updated?
I definitely think that the rules should be reviewed, because what is the ultimate objective of that category? It's meant to encourage filmmaking in those different countries. And like we've said earlier, there are filmmakers just making films from scratch with nothing. And, you know, who then looks and reviews within the country? There are films made in Yoruba language. There are films made in Igbo language. There are many films made that have no English in them at all. Who is looking and scouting?
Go ahead, Antoinette. Last word.
When it comes to filmmakers approaching feature films to either circulate it on the festival circuit or to be considered for top awards like this, should they still think about their audience first, or should they think about these rules? Because I feel like with a lot of these films, they're making it for their people. It's a reflection of themselves. So how does that match up against these rules that could possibly deter even more people who even hail from their respective countries to even acknowledge them or see them on the international level?
Antoinette Isama is a freelance journalist, and Ifeoma Fafonwa is a playwright, director, and founder of Eye Open Eye Productions. Thanks to you both for a wonderfully robust conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you don't already, make sure you follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, we're on Facebook and Instagram too. Our team of producers includes Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Temi Fagbenle. Alexander Boti is our senior producer. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Our engineers are Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, and our director and sound designer is Jay Cowett. David Gable is our master of pizzazz, and Lita Hallowell is our intern. Deidre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening this and every week. I hope you'll join me again next time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.